similar to what we saw the first wave of the caravan that came up about a week or so ago. The group immediately started throwing rocks and debris at our agents, taunting the agents. Once our agents were assaulted and the numbers started growing, we had, you know, two or three agents at a time initially facing hundreds of people at a time. They deployed tear gas to protect themselves and to protect the border.
Rodney Scott, he is chief patrol agent for the San Diego sector of the Border Patrol on CNN Today. It was yesterday that groups of migrants rushed the wall between Tijuana and San Diego. The Border Patrol responded with tear gas, as you just heard. 42 people who managed to make it across the border were arrested on the U.S. side, a similar number arrested in Mexico. The border was closed then for more than 5 hours in San Ysidro, which is one of the world's busiest border crossings. It processes nearly 100,000 people crossing from Mexico to the United States every day. Jean Guerrero is a reporter at KPBS in San Diego. She's been reporting from the Mexican side of the border. Hi there.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, tell us more about what happened. How did this storming of the border, as it's been described, how did that happen?
So I think it's important to clarify that most of the people who participated in this march, they tell me that the intent was not to storm the border, that they were marching to protest the long wait times that they face as asylum seekers due to the backlogs at the ports of entry, and that it was just a minority among them, some unruly members among them who kind of led to things spiraling out of control by throwing rocks once they arrived at the border, and then some people actually jumping the fence and getting through the fence into the United States.
So for the peaceful protesters, what were they fed up with? What were they frustrated by?
It used to be that if you fear for your life in Central America, you could come to the United States, you could tell a border agent that you fear for your life, that you want to ask for asylum, and you would be taken into the port of entry for processing, and you would have your asylum case, often in detention, sometimes released on parole with GPS monitoring, ankle bracelets. Now, for the past year or so, you've seen people being turned away, allegedly due to capacity issues at the ports, and they're told that they have to wait weeks, sometimes months, before they're able to even speak with a U.S. official. And a lot of people are fed up with the long wait times because they don't want to wait, but also because they fear for their lives within Mexico. MS-13, 18th Street, a lot of the gangs that these families are fleeing in their home countries have networks that operate throughout Mexico. And Tijuana is currently seeing its most violent year in history. Homicides are at an all-time high. These people, they just do not feel safe having to wait in Tijuana, and they feel that they have a right to ask for asylum in the United States.
What are their living conditions now as they wait? Where are they?
Most of them, so about 5,000 of them, are staying at this sports complex that's been turned into a makeshift migrant shelter by the city. It's extremely crowded, extremely cramped and overcrowded. There's issues with the porta potties that are overflowing. A lot of unsanitary conditions. UN human rights officers who are monitoring say they fear that there will be a spread of disease, that there's a lot of health risks associated with the conditions in which they're living. But really, it's the only place that Tijuana has been able to find for this migrant caravan. All of the other migrant shelters are already at capacity because of an influx of people fleeing violence within Mexico, southern states like Guerrero and Michoacán. So there really is no space that the city has been able to find to accommodate these migrants. People are already spilling out onto the streets, sleeping on the sidewalks, in tents, on blankets, just all around this sports complex, which is way over capacity. Initially, it was supposed to fit 2,000 people. There's already more than 5,000 people in there. And there's thousands more people who are on their way. There's talk of eventually 10,000 people total being on the streets in Tijuana. And it's already an unprecedented number. Tijuana has never seen this many homeless migrants on its streets.
And there have been tensions that we've heard in the news between the residents and these migrants.
Exactly. Just like you have seen a lot of animosity about this migrant caravan within the United States and in the Trump administration. There's also a lot of anger, xenophobia, racism being expressed towards members of the caravan, verbal and physical attacks. You see people in Tijuana wearing Make Tijuana Great Again baseball caps, sort of like the Make America Great Again baseball caps that you see at Trump rallies. And there's just this idea that the migrant caravan is, people see them as an eyesore because there really is no space that is being made for them aside from the sports complex. And you also see people staying in on the streets of this upscale beach neighborhood called Playas de Tijuana, right by the border fence, people sleeping on the beach. And that's where a lot of wealthier Mexicans live, and they have been coming to the caravan and telling them to go home, that they're not wanted here. So it just seems like the situation is going to continue to escalate because of the fact that you see more and more people coming and Tijuana just not really doing anything to accommodate them.
Or the U.S. letting them in to claim asylum in an expeditious manner.
Well,
So meanwhile, there's talk of this deal between Donald Trump and the president-elect Andrés Manuel López Obrador, some kind of deal to keep the migrants in Mexico. What's the story there?
López Obrador has said in the past that he's not going to do what he calls the dirty work of the United States when it comes to stopping asylum seekers from Central America from reaching the United States. He's been very vocal about how he's not going to do that. But in the past few days, he's been engaged in talks with the Trump administration about essentially giving asylum seekers a safe place to stay, allowing these asylum seekers to stay in Mexico while their asylum claims are processed in the United States. It's very unclear how that's going to work because, like I said, there's so many of these asylum seekers who fear for their lives within Mexico, and currently in the border towns there aren't. There just isn't sufficient infrastructure to take all of these people in. But that's what the negotiations have been about. So he's going to be sworn in on December 1st, so this coming weekend. So whatever is going to happen, it's going to be decided very quickly, just in the next few days.
Jean Guerrero, reporter at KPBS in San Diego, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Okay, let's talk about the legal issues swirling around what's happening at the border with Jessica Levinson. She's a law professor at Loyola Law School and our regular Monday Legal Eagle. Hi.
Hi.
Okay, first, let us get this question out of the way. Is it legal for Customs and Border Protection to fire tear gas and rubber bullets?
I think it is in this circumstance because what they have said is we were under attack. Basically, people were trying to violently cross the border, and so we were protecting ourselves. We were keeping the peace. If people were just trying to walk across the border without more, then I don't think you get to fire tear gas.
What about when the president tweets he wants to permanently close the border between the U.S. and Mexico? Can he unilaterally do that?
That would be extraordinary. And my sense is that no, even though the president of the United States has broad authority to protect our country, has broad authority in the area of immigration control, and we've seen this in recent Supreme Court cases, I think that completely closing a border would require a showing that there is a constant, almost emergency level circumstance where we have to protect ourselves. And I think that that showing would be very difficult.
Well, certainly the president has been arguing that this is a threat. He's been arguing that for weeks leading up to the midterms, that this migrant caravan poses an exigent threat to the United States. So by him just declaring it a threat, is that enough?
No. So even the president of the United States, who has broad latitude when it comes to these sorts of national security and immigration issues, still doesn't get to wave a magic wand. So the president certainly can say we are facing a threat and point to one thing like the migrant caravan. But if he says we're going to close an entire border and there isn't anything specific happening, you still get to have those statements evaluated in court. So I still don't think that You tweet it and it is so. And frankly, we've seen this in other areas where the president has tweeted, we will now take and then kind of fill in the blank sweeping policy, and then it gets scaled back by his advisors later in the day or the week.
Well, speaking of his advisors, we learned that there was internal dissent at the White House over his plan to send the U.S. military to the border before the midterms. And a couple of people, John Kelly included, arguing that this is unconstitutional to do that. Can you explain?
Yeah. So we have an act, a federal law called the Posse Comitatus Act, which any West Wing fans will be well aware of. And it essentially says you can't force our military, our army, to be a federal law enforcement. And you can't force them, for instance, or allow them to use force.
On U.S. soil.
On U.S. soil. Of course, when you go abroad, that's almost the purpose of the military in many circumstances. And so the idea is now that the troops can go to the border and can provide backup and assistance and kind of infrastructure support to Customs and Border Protection. But now there's a memo which says if the troops see that the Customs and Border Protection officers are, for instance, being attacked, they can step in and help. But they can't act like your local police force. There's still federal law preventing that.
But step in and help, would that mean what exactly? What if it does mean using tear gas and rubber bullets? Isn't that a use of force?
It is a use of force. So the memo uses broad language, and it is essentially says that you could protect a Customs and Border Protection agent, that you can do cursory searches, that there are other ways that you can help without arresting and detaining. But this is something where, I mean, your question goes to exactly an internal debate that's happened in the White House, which is what are the exclusions to this federal law and how far can the troops go?
Okay, let's turn to another story in the news that was actually buried on Friday, on Black Friday. And this was the federal government, the White House's own report that climate change is a dire reality, that it's going to affect us negatively in every sphere of our economy, health, welfare, et cetera, et cetera. At the same time, there's a lawsuit that's being brought by about 24 young people who are arguing that the government is violating their rights by continuing to allow activities that harm the climate, therefore harming them. What responsibility does the government have, especially when it produces a report that basically confirms what all the scientists have been saying, to do something to lessen the effects of climate change?
Well, so the answer is we don't know, and we might not know for a while. So this was a suit that was filed in 2015 by 21 miners. And what they filed the suit in the district court in Oregon. And again, it's been going on for 3 years now. And what they basically do is they say, federal government, you have ruined our environment. You allowed for all of these activities like coal and gas and carbon dioxide emissions, and it's hurting us. And we have a right for you to affirmatively stop doing that. And it is, in fact, a fundamental right. And so what the plaintiffs are arguing here is this isn't an environmental case. It's a civil rights case. And most of these cases actually are not successful. They're dismissed because either the plaintiffs are said to lack standing because this is a so-called general grievance or a political question, or courts just say, yeah, I don't see any case law that recognizes that you have a right to basically a safe environment. This case is different, where the district court judge has given them more leeway to go forward. But because of that, this case is very similar to other cases where we've seen the defendants, meaning the federal government, try every tactic in the Ninth Circuit, in the Supreme Court, numerous times to try and get this case dismissed. And so where this case is right now is stayed. It's basically nowhere. The district court has said, we've heard from the Supreme Court, we need to allow you to appeal again to the Ninth Circuit. And so the really long answer to your question is, we don't know how this case, which I think is a really important case, will play out. As to the report, that might not even, frankly, make it into the trial, because this isn't really about what the report said. To most people, the report is not new news. Mm-hmm. This is about whether or not we can vindicate those rights in a court of law, because that, many people feel, is really the last place that we can try and force the federal government's hand.
Well, it's an interesting idea, because if if the government were a private company accused by its own board of directors of negligence, in a sense, or ignoring the facts, couldn't the shareholders or any, you know, employees, couldn't they sue the company for gross negligence, for failing to make their workplace safe?
Yes. So this would be different legal theories. For instance, I mean, you mentioned negligence. That would be like civil tort law. But yes, if the federal government was a private company, there'd be different ways to try and vindicate your rights. In this case, what's, I think, particularly difficult for plaintiffs is that they're trying to fit their claims of federal government, you need to affirmatively do something to help us, into existing law where we really haven't seen those laws used this way before. Certainly, if and when this case goes to trial, which it has been almost going to trial for quite a long time now, everybody will watch. And if it's successful, then I think we'll see many more of these cases crop up.
Jessica Levinson teaches law at Loyola Law School, and she's our regular League Legal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, how renters are rebelling against high rents. That story is next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Just over half of the homes here in LA are rentals. That's the biggest share of any major American city. And most renters here spend at least a third of their income on rent. And as we all know, the rents keep going up. With so many people feeling the strain, the renters' rights movement is expanding, and it's expanding in some unexpected places. KCRW's Anna Scott has the story.
Shame on you!
If you want to know what LA's housing crisis sounds like, here you go. It's after dark on a normally quiet street on LA's west side. About a dozen people are rallying outside a two-story house. The house belongs to a landlord named Stephen Taylor. His company, Taylor Equities, owns at least a dozen buildings around LA. It's known for buying older properties in hot neighborhoods, renovating them, and raising rents. This rally is to protest rent increases and evictions at one particular building in Silver Lake. Taylor took it over about 9 months ago, and in what's become a familiar conflict around the city, tenants say he wants them out, while he says that's not true. One of the tenants, Melinda Peffer, has lived at the property almost 17 years. For most of that time, she says, she was far from a tenant's rights activist.
To be honest, I didn't realize if somebody said landlord harassment or trying to move people off the property, I had no idea really what that entailed.
Peffer and other tenants say Taylor has tried to drive them out with constant disruptive construction work, among other complaints. Peffer and her family also got a 90-day notice to move out. Taylor said he was traveling last week and not available for a taped interview. But in an email, he called the harassment allegation hurtful and entirely untrue. He said he's tried to make renovations as unobtrusive as possible. He also said he's given 90-day notices only to people whose apartments need major work, and that he has tried working with tenants, agreeing to phase in the new higher rent gradually in some cases, or in others, helping people find cheaper places to live. I ask Peffer what she hopes this protest will accomplish.
Well, we hope that the landlord would have a change of heart, but I think also just bringing more awareness to displacement. The demographics of our building are a little different than most that have been facing a lot of these issues. So part of what I wanted to be able to do is shed a little bit more light on what other people are going through.
She's talking about the fact that she and others who live in her building are relatively well off compared to a lot of renters in LA. It's a sign of how bad the city's housing crisis is that they're out here protesting. In general, the people spending the biggest chunk of their income on rent in this city are Black and Latino. The tenants I speak to tonight are white and have middle-class jobs. Peffer works in marketing. One of her neighbors who's here is a cartoonist for The New Yorker and other places. But even for them, there aren't that many places they can afford to move to, at least not without major sacrifices.
Everyone who showed up tonight, we have to keep showing up for tenants across the city who are facing eviction. And that's the only way that we're ever going to build power and change anything.
It wasn't just the tenants who decided to come out here on their own. This protest was organized by the Los Angeles Tenants Union, a group that didn't even exist until 3 years ago.
Shame on you.
In the past year, the LA Tenants Union has put together protests outside different landlords' homes or offices from here to Venice Beach to Orange County. They've also organized rent strikes in some cases.
If they're going to show up to our homes, try to make us feel like we're not supposed to be there, well, we're going to come to your house and we're going to make your life hell.
In this case, the protest is kind of a last-ditch effort. Most of the tenants in the Silver Lake building have already left. Out of 36 apartments, less than half are occupied. And the building is not rent stabilized. That means legally, the landlord can raise rents as much as he wants and evict people for almost any reason. But one of the tenants' union organizers, Jesenia Maldonado, says she's seen this kind of rally work.
I mean, we've seen a few examples of how that can really either sway a landlord into even thinking about negotiating with tenants or just prolong their stay instead of it being like an immediate eviction. So I'm hopeful.
But there won't be any negotiations tonight. Nobody comes in or out of Taylor's home during the rally. In his email, Taylor said he has met with the protesters face to face, but they said no to a follow-up meeting. He said, quote, "I believe discussion, as opposed to demonstration, would be a more productive path forward, and my invitation stands." One of Taylor's neighbors does respond to the protest. He comes out to complain about the noise and gets into it a little with the demonstrators.
Disturbing the peace.
Come to our house.
A private security guard also shows up, and he gets into a shouting match with the protesters.
I'm chicken. I pay a mortgage. You want it about rent.
Whatever comes of this demonstration, the math of the situation is clear. A newly renovated one-bedroom at the building in Silver Lake goes for $2,500 a month. Melinda Peffer, the tenant you heard earlier, pays $1,500 for the one-bedroom she shares with her husband and 7-year-old daughter.
I think the fact that we've been able to have affordable housing has allowed my husband to go back to school. He just graduated from medical school, and it was enabled us to, you know, be able to survive on one income and not have to pay 40 or 50% of our income towards rent.
At the heart of LA's affordability crisis, there's a housing shortage, not enough room for everyone who wants to live here. So if you've lived in the same apartment for a long time with the same rent and you have to move, it's going to be tough to find anything as inexpensive. For some people, that means giving up graduate school, vacations, or leaving a school district. For others, it could mean living in a car, on a couch, or in a tent. In 2018, rents in LA went up for the fourth year straight. The median price for a two-bedroom is now about $1,700 a month. That's 40% higher than the rest of the country. For KCRW, I'm Anna Scott.
Coming up, the campaign that made it okay to talk about politicians' sex lives.
In our recent history, the presumed next president of the United States wound up in his alleyway in the middle of the night with a group of journalists, and no one knew what to do because no one had ever been in that situation.
A conversation with the director and screenwriter of a movie about Gary Hart's 1988 campaign. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. From Monica Lewinsky to Stormy Daniels, the sex lives of presidents are fair game these days. Of course, it hasn't always been that way. Tabloid political coverage can really be traced back to the 1988 presidential election, when Democratic candidate Gary Hart was discovered to have been having an affair with a young woman named Donna Rice. You have probably seen that famous photo of Rice sitting on Hart's lap on a yacht called Monkey Business.
Now, here's what I don't figure out. You're running for the highest office in the land. You're going to take a little trip to Bimini with a couple of ladies. And you're going to go down and charter a boat. Now, of all the boat names there are, like Mother or Mother Teresa, you hire a boat called Monkey Business? That's not good thinking.
Johnny Carson, of course. Well, the affair erupted into a huge political scandal. It led to Hart, who was the presumptive Democratic nominee, to abandon his campaign. Now a feature film has been made about that incident. It's called The Front Runner, and it stars Hugh Jackman as Gary Hart. Jason Reitman directed the movie. He joins me now. Hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Great. And also Jay Carson is here. He wrote the screenplay. Welcome to you.
Hi. Thanks, Madeline.
Great to have you both. All right. So, Jason, why did you want to tell this story now?
You know, I have to admit that I'm young enough that I don't really remember these events from when they happened. I remember hearing their names, but it wasn't until I heard a Radiolab episode, actually, a few years ago that centered around the Hart scandal, that was centered around Matt Bai's book on it, that I thought, this happened? Just in our recent history, the presumed next president of the United States wound up in his alleyway in the middle of the night with a group of journalists and... no one knew what to do because no one had ever been in that situation before. They'd been staking him out. And that it was the first time his private life mattered, the first time, you know, a sex scandal mattered. And that this guy went from being the presumed next president to leaving politics forever in less than a week. It was a thriller. It felt like a movie, and it had all this connective tissue with all the things we seem to be talking about today.
It's kind of incredible that he actually left the race, right, Jay? I mean, he was the front runner, and in a week he said, nope, okay, that's it for me. That's a pretty remarkable turn of events we can't really wrap our minds around in the era of Access Hollywood.
No, it's interesting. That's actually one of the big changes, and it's one of the things that struck me through the process of writing and making this movie. You know, I literally watched it one day and I thought, where's the moment where he walks into, you know, I was a political operative for a long time, where he walks into a room of people like me and says, okay, what do I need to do to get out of this? I'll do anything. Because in my time in politics, that's what people did. But he won't do anything to get out of it, which is, you know, it's interesting and it's an admirable part of it. He hits up against this wall and decides, okay, there are things I won't do to get out of a scandal. I'm going to leave the race.
Jay, talk about, because the other side of this story is, of course, the media and what it says about how reporters get stories and what they're interested in and how they can make or break a candidate. Can you talk about how the Miami Herald, which broke this story, how it got the story in the first place? Because that, too, is a remarkable tale.
It was. Jason and I had the same reaction when Matt, you know, first told us the story that's in his book. And that's one of the other incredible. We talk about the alleyway scene a lot, that there's a guy that's going to be the next president confronted in his alleyway by journalists who are asking him about his sex life. But the middle of the night phone call from someone who just rings up a Miami Herald reporter, Tom Fiedler, and says, hey, Gary Hart's having an affair with my friend. It really happened. It's in the movie. And that's just crazy. It you know, the call happened. It was true. It was right. He chased it down. We take a look at everyone's role in this, though. That, you know, there are people that have, you know, in an age where journalists are being attacked and called the enemies of the state, you know, should we be nicer to the press in this movie? We are asking everyone to take a look at the role that we all played getting here. Voters, candidates, operatives, the press, because, you know, something happened back there and we've it's put us on a path to where we are today. And we all played a role in that.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting also is the defensiveness that the reporters are on. But they don't come across as completely convinced or completely solid that they should go ahead and do this, that they were questioning themselves as to whether or not they should publish this story, whether it was appropriate.
I mean, Jason did a great job in casting both the staff and the journalists. It's the first where everybody feels real, because campaigns are hilarious. People are funny. They're really smart. They're profane. And what I see in that and what we intended for it to be is human beings wrestling with really tough decisions. You get a call in the middle of the night, someone says that the guy who's going to be the next president is having an affair. What do you do? And Steve Zissou gives a great performance, I think, of someone trying to figure that out. You know, a human being trying to figure, what's the right call here? Can I ignore that? Should I ignore that? How do I ignore that? It's just really, you know, it's great to watch.
Yeah. And Jason, what did you want to convey with that side of the story? How did you want to portray the reporters?
Well, I want it to be as open-ended as possible. You know, our idea going in was to have so many main characters that any audience member has the opportunity to kind of hook their line to any of the actors and perhaps even upon rewatch, you know, connect through a different actor. And that's been kind of fun to watch with audiences as they either, you know, come up and say that they, you know, they watched it through Gary and Lee Hart's eyes or whether they watched it through someone on the campaign or one of the journalists. I mean, even amongst the journalists, you know, there's men, women, young, old, at the Post, at the Herald, they each kind of give a different opportunity on what's chewing away at them. And whether you know, you're following through the Herald reporter who is, you know, wondering how to cover this and what will come of it, or, you know, A.J. Parker, our character at the Washington Post, who, you know, eventually asks that question about whether or not Gary Hart has ever committed adultery.
That's a fictionalized character, right? The A.J.
Parker
character.
I mean, it's an amalgam of two real life reporters, Paul Taylor from the Post and E.J. Dionne of the New York Times. You know, Paul Taylor, of course, in real life, asked Hart in a press conference, "Have you ever committed adultery?" And it was E.J. Dionne who did the interview in which Hart said, "You know, go ahead, follow me around." And we wanted to create a narrative line of one journalist that married those two ideas, that admired Hart, felt uncomfortable about the responsibility of having to ask these personal questions.
Do you see them as different than the Miami Herald reporters? Because the Miami Herald reporters are portrayed more as kind of schlumpy, gumshoe reporters who are confronting the candidate in a back alley.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think of the Miami Herald reporters as schlumpy and gumshoe, although I do think that they were doing something for the first time, and we wanted to establish that this idea that rather than take part of the kind of the traditional political journalist process, they were doing undercover work for the first time. You know, they were trailing someone on a plane and staking out her townhouse and staking out his townhouse. And I think they kind of admit to having never done that before. But honestly, across the board, what I'm interested in is the pressure that is put on journalists as well as editors. I mean, you have to remember that this is the beginning of the moment in which we question whether the editors control the story. You know, Ben Bradley, while speaking to David Frost a couple years after this, said, look, if TV news is covering this, if other newspapers are covering this, how do we not cover this? And we put that line specifically in the movie because of that. And that's true now more than ever. You know, you wake up and you open your phone and you open up the news app and there's an article on the midterms and it's right next to an article about Ariana Grande and Pete Davidson breaking up, and they're kind of given same weight, they're given from the same source, and the gossip article is there because we're clicking it, like we're asking for it, and I'm no different. I want to click that article, and I guess I'm I'm curious about my own curiosity.
Mm. Do you have an opinion on whether or not the story should have been published?
It depends on the day, honestly. I mean, that's been part of doing this is we have wanted to, if you notice in this movie, we try to give everyone in every scene the absolute strongest possible argument. Part of what we argue for in this is that, you know, pre-88, there's this rule that that someone's personal life is never relevant. Post-88, that someone's personal life is always relevant. If we make an argument at all, it's that we should move away from the absolutes on that. Certainly there were times before 88 where it was relevant and we didn't know about it. And certainly there were times post 88 where it hasn't been relevant, but and yet we've known every prurient detail.
Hmm. I mean, we were having this same kind of question with Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky in the 90s. And a lot of people on the left said, look, it shouldn't matter. He can still run the country. What his private life is his private life. I think a lot of those people now in the Me Too era are thinking perhaps differently about that, about their original opinion.
Yeah, and I suppose there are a lot of filters that it needs to go through. And certainly the idea that this was in the workplace when it came to Monica Lewinsky certainly factors in and factors into the way we talk about it today. And kind of thank God we're having that conversation today with Gary Hart. You know, Gary Hart and Donna Rice met on a boat. They met at a party, and they, you know, clearly had chemistry enough that he invited her to his townhouse. Was it a mistake? Yeah. I mean, it was a human mistake. And the question is, at what point do these human mistakes matter? And that's something that we're trying to discuss in 2018, but it's really hard because the volume today is at a 12, and our current president is incredibly indecent. So the volume is so high right now. You go on Twitter and you say the wrong word, and it's like you're going to get your head ripped off. The opportunity of 1987 and the litmus test of this story allows for a candidate who had big ideas, was prescient, was smart, was electable, and at the same time was a human being who made human mistakes.
And there had been rumors of other affairs as well. So presumably, or maybe, not presumably, maybe those would have come out too. I don't know.
Yeah, there were. I mean, there were periods, long periods, where Senator Hart was separated from his wife. They're still married. He just had refused to talk about it at all. He basically, his opinion was that's no one else's business but mine and Lee's. So,
what does he think now? Does he still think that?
You know, we didn't show the script or we showed the movie, the completed movie, to people. But Jason has gotten to know him a lot better than I have.
What does he think?
And that is to say that I still don't know him very well at all. Look, he's a very private person, and that's true, and we make that very clear. You know, he left politics because he did not want to answer questions like these, and he found them to be irrelevant. Now, that may be true, that may be false, and that is debatable, and certainly that's the debate that we're trying to open up with the movie. We want the audience to walk out and think about, okay, what is relevant? What actually matters? What matters to us individually? I brought Gary, you know, I reached out to Gary Hart before we made the movie. I thought that was the decent thing to do. I reached out to Donna Rice. I reached out to the campaign team. And then after the fact, brought the movie back to them, you know, brought the movie to Donna, brought it to Gary, brought it to Tom Fiedler out in Boston. And it's funny, the first reaction everyone has to the movie is Hugh Jackman is an amazing actor. And it's funny because they walk out of the theater and I forget that they've just watched a movie. Like that is what their experience was. They watched a movie and Hugh Jackman is just undeniably great. The next thing that Gary asked was, do I really talk like that? And his wife, Lee, said, yes, darling, that's exactly how you speak. His first question at all times was, you know, how is my wife being portrayed? And he was happy about that. And as far as himself, look, I mean, he wants to be remembered for his ideas. And so I think it's complicated for him that his legacy continues to be the story. Now, we're taking a different look at this story than it historically has been. I think historically it's been a joke with the punchline of a name of a boat, and we're taking a hopefully more thoughtful approach to it. And I think he's probably happy about that, but also, but at the same time, you know, if he were to list his accomplishments, he would talk about his time as an aside. He would talk about the 18 books that he's written since this all happened. He would talk about all the ways in which he wants to contribute to this country. And it would probably frustrate him that what we all seem to care about is a scandal.
Well, I thank you both very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, indeed.
Jason Reitman, director, Jay Carson, screenwriter of the movie The Frontrunner. Coming up, we'll remember magician and actor Ricky Jay next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. One of the greatest magicians of all time, Ricky Jay, has died. Here he is doing a magic trick on Late Night with Conan O'Brien in 2002.
What is the card which you actually took?
Can I say?
Yes, please.
Four of diamonds.
Four of diamonds. Four. U-R-O-F-D-I-A-M-O-N-D-S, the four of diamonds.
Well, he was not only a magician, he was a performer. He acted in some 40 films and TV shows, including Boogie Nights. He wrote 11 books. And Ricky Jay appeared on our air many times over the years on KCRW's The Treatment and Unfictional. He even had his own weekly radio essay series on KCRW back in 2003 called Jay's Journal. Here to help us remember Ricky Jay now is Mark Singer. He profiled Ricky Jay in 1993 for The New Yorker, where he's a staff writer. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you. And also joining us, Howard Rodman. He is a friend of Ricky's and also the former president of the Writers Guild of America West. He teaches screenwriting at USC. Welcome to you.
Thank you, Madeline.
Well, Howard, the two of you met in college. You've been friends for a very long time. How would you describe him?
The guy who I met in the early 1970s is the same guy who Mark profiled and the same guy that you knew if you saw him on TV. Despite being, I think the Ricky Jay that you see is in some ways very much a self-creation, but it was a consistent one and it seemed to have been there from the very beginning, which is to say somebody who is obsessively concerned with practicing his craft, deeply, deeply generous to the history of that craft and to his fellow practitioner, and a master of narratives. I think a lot of his magic was about his extraordinary sleight of hand, but a lot of it, too, was about his ability to craft a narrative that always placed your attention where he wasn't.
Oh, interesting. So he would tell these stories and you'd be beguiled by them as he's doing his tricks, so you wouldn't notice the sleight of hand?
You would be beguiled in exactly the way he wanted you to be beguiled.
Mark, talk about that, because in your profile, you say you spent 2 years with him and you could never figure out how he did it.
Well, I never wanted to know how he did it, actually. I don't understand the insistence that some people have upon, quote-unquote, knowing how you made the effect happen. That, to me, would be destroying the theater of the effect, which was really what Ricky's was his forte, was orchestrating, as Howard was describing, this narrative. But also, this is a sui generis artist. Do we know how Matisse painted, really? Do we need to know how he mixed his paints and how he applied the brush to the canvas? Or can we accept that the result is just an exquisite work of art? And with Ricky, he's an extraordinarily private person. Even his friends would acknowledge that there was a private Ricky Jay within the private Ricky Jay that they knew, who wasn't entirely accessible. But what you got was what you wanted with Ricky, this dazzling performer, this brilliant scholar, a writer with the New York Times referred to him in a piece a couple of years ago as the last of the great 19th century stylists. Maybe it was the 18th century, I'll forget. But anyway, the point is, that was Ricky. He was uniquely who he was, and I didn't need to know how he did it. I just wanted him to continuously reignite my sense of wonder, and he did.
Let me just play a clip of tape from his PBS series where he talks about that, about this need for people to know how the tricks are done and why that's ridiculous.
People frequently talk about how much more difficult it is to cheat in a card game than to perform good sleight of hand. But if you think about it, what makes magic different is that it's inherently honest. You tell someone you're going to deceive them before you deceive them. In some way, that makes it more difficult.
Howard, tell us what it was like watching him perform.
I had the good fortune one evening to watch Ricky practice a work in progress, which is to say a sleight that he was thinking of introducing into his show. And I was as close to him as I am right now to this telephone I'm holding. And for the life of me, I could not see where his fingers went one way and reality went the other way. You never saw that moment. But as Mark says, it was not about trying to figure out how he did it. The real miracle was that he did it. And I think his, again, generosity in combining the astonishing, obsessive hours and hours and decades of practice it took him to be able to do that with the fact that he wanted you to be fooled by it.
How did he begin doing magic, Mark?
Well, he began as a very young boy. I mean, as a small child, his grandfather, his maternal grandfather, was a man named Max Katz. He was a CPA, but an amateur magician, and actually at one point, I believe, president of the Society of American Magicians. And he took Ricky under his wing, and Max Katz knew the greats of his day. Ricky was born in 1946, so these are a lot of performers who'd been around for decades, but when Ricky was seeing them, they were still at the peak of their craft, and he, through his grandfather, was more or less apprenticed to these great magicians, Slidini, Flosso, especially Di Vernon, a man named Charlie Miller, who's less well-known, and Ricky often described, you know, the relationship between the magician and his mentor as like a master-sensei relationship, and he found the best people, and they came to respect him because they saw how dedicated he was to the craft, and that began at a very young age.
And you wrote in your profile that he was not supported really in this passion by his parents. His parents weren't very supportive, and he didn't really want to talk about his parents.
He didn't really want to talk about them, and I never pried. You know, I once asked David Mamet, who was very close to Ricky, if Ricky had ever described to him, you know, details of his personal life. And David said, "I can't remember." And I said, "You can't remember whether he told you or you can't remember what he said." He said, "I can't remember another way to answer your question without seeming rude." So his friends protected that privacy. The line that Ricky had about his parents, he left home as a teenager, 15 years old. He said, "The only thing you need to know about my father was that he brushed his teeth with Ipana and he used Brill cream in his hair. And Ricky, when he was 10, switched the position of the twos." And he said, "So what you need to know about my father is that after he had brushed his teeth with Brill cream, he put the Ipana in his hair."
Did you glean anything more about his background, Howard?
It would not be for me to say. I would rather talk about, I think, his amazing desire to take the lives of the unheralded and put them in the grand library. I think to Ricky, the proprietor of a flea circus or a dog that could count and point to cards dealt on the floor, or an armless man from the 1700s who was the most exquisite engraver and calligrapher of his era, these were people who, to Ricky, belonged in the everyday library and canon of the rest of us, and he dedicated a large part of his life to making sure they were not forgotten and they were remembered in the right way, utterly without condescension. He published a letterpress quarterly. Now, printing a letterpress quarterly with gorgeous engravings on expensive paper with no advertisement is not the kind of thing a sane person will do if your income's dependent on the vagaries of the entertainment industry. But he did it, I think, because he felt that by his labor and passion, he could resurrect these lives from the dead. And I think all of us are the richer for the attention he paid to those who were written off as curiosities.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for joining us today and sharing your memories of Ricky Jay. Howard Rodman, who teaches at USC, Mark Singer, staff writer for The New Yorker. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
And thank you for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.